Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Endless Zoom meetings, inefficient communication flows, the social and professional growth that comes with time together in the office, and missing that. Well, that's a couple of the many downsides of working from home. Upsides? Possibly many there, too. No nightmare commute, a more relaxed environment, greater efficiency without constant interruption, and doing those same endless Zoom meetings in your PJs. The point is, what will happen next? As states move to reopen, will offices reopen too? Will companies ever return to that time-honored five-day office-based work week? Do you even want to? Or, and this is what I'm particularly interested in, have the past 3 months revealed a better and more flexible way to think about work? So this hour on Point, the future of working from home. And we're joined today by Cal Newport. He joins us from Washington. He's a professor of computer science at Georgetown University and author of a recent article in The New Yorker magazine titled Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed. He's also author of the 2016 book Deep Work, Rules for Focused Success in a Distracted World. Cal Newport, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me. I can confirm I am not wearing my PJs right now as we have this remote meeting.
Well, and we don't even have a camera on you, so whatever you want to wear, it's totally fine by me. Now, listen, first of all, I actually just wanted to ask you, I presume you have been working from home for quite some time now. Is that right?
Yeah, since March, for sure.
Since March. Okay, and how's that been?
Well, as a college professor, it's been kind of interesting. I teach math classes where I typically will fill a large chalkboard over the course of a lecture, and I've been instead using a Zoom shared whiteboard that's about 12 inches by 12 inches. So like a lot of people right now in the knowledge sector, I have had to adjust quite a bit to make what worked before work now.
Do you think your teaching is as good or the learning is as good?
I think you definitely miss something by not having faces, actually being able to see the faces of your student in the classroom. I didn't realize until we went remote how much information you get by seeing those little micro muscle movements that tell you, you know what, they're not following what I'm saying now, or this makes sense. And so I think that was the most dislocating portion or impact of this shift, was staring at a screen and not a room of people.
Right. And, you know, I will get into the details that you reveal and the stories you tell in your New Yorker article in just a second. But Professor Newport, I just want to ask you, if you had the choice or when you have the choice, would you prefer to actually be on campus and working in front of your students and with your colleagues?
I think for teaching and dealing with my graduate students, 100%. I think, however, I would be okay with more of our interminable faculty meetings remaining something that I don't have to schlep into campus for. So we have the good and the bad there.
Indeed. Well, and that's the reality that I want to explore, right? Because I think there's an opportunity in terms of figuring out how to maximize the good that we've actually possibly learned from this last three-month period. And so I also want to just throw the number out here, because I'm thinking that perhaps many listeners hearing this right now might be, in fact, working from home. So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let us know, how has it gone for you? If you are one of the people working from home, has it worked? Do you think it's better? What are the upsides? What are the downsides? And in the future, how would you like work to change? What would you like us to have learned from this period of time? Again, that's 800-423-8255. Now, Professor Newport, we should also say that it's only actually a relatively small fraction of American workers who even have this choice of working from home. And I want to fully acknowledge once again that millions of Americans who do that essential work never had a choice, had to keep going into their offices, their factories, their businesses. And I thank every single one of them from the bottom of my heart. I just wanted to say that. But Professor Newport, you actually take this story way back, and you begin your article in the 1960s with a nascent effort to pull people out of the office. Can you tell us that story?
Now, we can trace the interest in remote work back to this early period. The term telecommute or telework actually came from a former NASA engineer and trained physicist named Jack Nils, who had gotten upset about traffic congestion. The rise of traffic congestion in the late 1960s and early 1970s, particularly in large urban areas like Los Angeles. And he had this idea, you know, if we could get rid of the central office that's in the middle of the city and that everyone has to drive into the middle of the city to get access to and replace it with small satellite offices all around the outside or periphery of the city, people would no longer have to do long commutes, but could walk or bike or make a quick car ride to the closest satellite office. And therefore, we could ease the traffic congestion problem. And with that idea, set in motion what was then decades of growing enthusiasm for, can we make this vision of work that does not require us all to gather in the same physical place? Can we make this vision a reality?
Yeah. And then you note that if the actual satellite office idea really didn't catch on as much as it might have, it's because technology actually, in your words, leapfrogged it.
Yeah. So he had a model in which there would be literal courier style runners moving between these different satellite offices to try to keep information and communication in sync. That all became a moot point once we had the rise of network computers in the office place. And I think this is where we really see mainstream excitement begin to grow for remote work, is where office work began to move onto the computer. And once office work began to move onto the computer, when you're at your desk at the central office or headquarters, well, then you could have that same computer at your house and potentially replicate all of these same activities that you did at the office at your house. So it was really the rise of the computer and the network computer revolution in the office place where we started to get a lot of mainstream excitement behind this idea of remote work.
And so then that brings about the, and I'm going to partake in a terrible cliche here, like the idealized vision of, you know, you could do your work from a beach in Fiji. Why not? Like, what difference does it make as long as you are connected? It was supposed to bring about this grand ideal of what work could be. And as for many things in modern life, part of that ideal was supposed to be lived out by, for example, Silicon Valley companies, who experimented a lot with having people not in the office. But it didn't always pan out. Why is that?
Yeah. So at first, this push for work from home was a technological problem to be solved. And that's where the energy came from, the engineers. You know, can we replicate email at home? Can we replicate word processing at home? Can we replicate shared file servers at home? Really, the last dominoes to fall in that progression was voice over IP, voice and video conferencing. So when we finally got that revolution in the first decade of the 2000s, we could now replicate meetings and even see other people. Once we could do that by 2006 or 2007, the engineers basically thought, okay, we've done it. We've taken every activity that you do at your desk, at the office, and have found a way to replicate it at home. And it was just a few years after this that the wheels came off the movement. Because once we handed it off from the engineers to the actual real people out there in the real world, we realized, oh, there are so many other factors that play a role in a successfully functioning office, that just replicating the behaviors at home is not enough to replicate everything that an organization successfully does.
Now, I full disclosure, what I'm about to say comes from a place of familiarity and love. My undergraduate degrees are in engineering, so I understand that mindset well. But isn't it also the most typical engineering thing to think, well, we can create this new artificial system that replicates another system and voila, it'll work. And forgetting about the human factors at play here. I mean, when we're talking about work, we were literally talking about how human beings engage themselves collectively towards, you know, an end goal. To take the people out of it always never made any sense to me. So what were some of the failures that happened when sort of the tools for working from home were unleashed in the wild?
Well, what we underestimated, and I'm using sort of the royal we to talk about, you know, engineers like us. what we underestimated was the value that in-person interaction was actually playing in helping to keep an organization together. So some of this value was in efficiency. I mean, it turns out if I can grab you in the hallway and talk to you for 3 minutes about an issue that we can resolve right there, that's replacing maybe a dozen or two back and forth emails that would pull at our attention throughout the day. So we miss those efficiencies. We miss subtle forms of productive cohesion. So a real big point in my article is that knowledge work is particularly haphazard as compared to other industries. There tends not to be in office work a lot of processes. There does not tend to be a lot of optimization thinking like you would see in industrial manufacturing. We tend to just kind of rock and roll, jump into meetings, jump on email, just figure things out on the fly. There was a lot of subtle governing behaviors that were happening in the office. You know, I can see you in the meeting. You look overwhelmed. I'm not going to put another task on your plate. Or there's going to be a social capital cost if I assign this to you, because I'm going to see you in the hallway and know that I just put something else on your plate. These type of subtle governors on the assignment of work, the distribution of work, et cetera, all of that goes away when you're purely virtual. And so we found that there was a productivity issue. You know, some offices did this okay, but a lot of offices found that the wheels really came off the bus when they tried to move more and more people remote, because there was so much we were relying on that we got from just seeing people in the hallway, in the conference room, in their offices, that played a big role.
Well, so that productivity issue absolutely is one of the things you write about this in your article, that in 2013, people might remember, then CEO of Yahoo, recently appointed, Marissa Mayer, ended all remote work. She needed people to come. She demanded that people come back in the office, saying that speed and quality are often sacrificed when we work from home. We need to be one Yahoo. And that starts with physically being together. So the experiment was so roundly failed at Yahoo that they just ended it.
Well, this was the irony of engineers leading the charge for technologically driven remote work, is that it was the engineering sector that then turned around and said, oh, this is not working. So I think there is the irony. They built this system and then stood back and said, uh-oh, maybe we missed something.
Well, Cal Newport, stand by here for just a moment, because we are talking about the lessons that businesses are learning from a forced work from home environment over the past 3 months, and whether we're really ready to make the big change, which is something workers have always been demanding, which isn't just work from home or office, but flexibility. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the future of working from home or remote work and the lessons that businesses are learning over the past 3 months of an enforced work from home world. I'm joined today by Cal Newport. He's a professor of computer science at Georgetown University and author of a recent article in The New Yorker titled "Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed." Let's actually just get a quick call in here right now. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Woodstock, Georgia. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. So, go ahead. Yep.
All right. So previous people have spoken about how difficult it is to get things done, and I understand that. Part of it is how does the work follow what you do remote? In other words, if you can break things up into small pieces and give them to somebody, they can get it done in a short period of time. That works great. If you try to coordinate with a bunch of people, you really need the right tools to do that. So it's not just mindset. It's also the ability to track what people are doing, without being overbearing about that. So tools that help with Scrum, like Kanban and Jira, those are really good in terms of organizing how people are going to get things done. And they also provide upward view so that management can see where people are doing. If you have like a daily Scrum and you spend maybe 5 minutes, everybody goes around the room, the virtual room, and says, I'm working on this, I'm working on that. If there's any follow-up or any issues, yeah, they're brought out right then and there and they're worked through. The other thing is about innovating. A lot of work environments aren't really keen toward that. They say they are, but they're not. And that's where we're really going to have to go in the future because, you know, disruption and interruption, that's great in terms of how we're going to do things, get things done. You know, because we've done things in the past that don't work really well. Let's try changing some of those things.
Yeah.
But also be attuned to the fact that if you interrupt too much, you're not going to get anything done.
Without a doubt.
It's a balance. And, you know, we're working in the right direction. I mean, the work isn't going to go back to production necessarily, unless you're going to be in an environment where automation is going to be a big part.
Mm. Well, Mike, thank you so much for that call. Cal Newport, did you want to respond to him?
Mike brings up a point that echoes what I found in my research as well, that if you look to office-style work that has successfully translated to the remote environment, you find software development as one of those examples. And my argument, it's because for unrelated reasons, software development has a very structured approach to their work. They use agile methodologies like Scrum, like Kanban, like the caller mentioned. With this structure in place, they don't have to rely on as much the sort of heuristics, productivity heuristics you can get from being in person. So I think he's right. If we're going to succeed with significant remote work in the near future, we're probably going to have to get a much more serious about how we actually structure our work in the office environment.
Okay. So, Cal, stand by for just a moment, because I want to now bring into the conversation Nicholas Bloom. He joins us from Stanford, California. He's a professor of economics at Stanford University with a focus on management practice. And he's a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. And he's recently authored a paper headlined, "The Bright Future of Working from Home." Professor Bloom, welcome to you.
Hi there, Magna.
So you see mass working from home as here to stay. Why?
Because I think it's going to be very successful. So I should be really clear what I mean by working from home. There's a huge difference between full-time under COVID,
yeah,
which right now is pretty horrible for many of us with kids and you know, broadband connection problems and sitting in bathrooms and bedrooms, versus post-COVID, which is going to be part, you know, 2-3 days a week. So full-time working from home is problematic, but part-time seems to be great.
Well, so that's an important distinction, because in your paper, you write that, for example, in 2018, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, I'm quoting you here, found that 8% of all employees worked from home at least one day a week. So you're talking, is that what you're talking about? Like increasing that number of sort of partial work from home, the number of people who might be doing that?
Yes, just to give you a sense of how weird full-time working from home is, before COVID, only 2% of people did that. So, you know, it's extremely unusual. And having worked on this for years, I can tell you most people that worked from home full-time before COVID were people who had moved for job reasons from something else. You know, you talk to someone and they'd say, hey, look, my wife got a new job in Cleveland. I wanted to stay in my current firm, but we moved to Cleveland, so I'm full-time at home. So it was pretty unusual. And now 40% of Americans are working from home full time. You know, going back to the previous discussion, working from home full time is really problematic due to issues around creativity and motivation. So if you, yeah, you know, I've talked to so many firms and run surveys for the last few weeks, very few people are planning to continue full time working from home forever. It's 2-3 days a week at home, 2-3 days a week in the office.
What? So I am so glad to hear that, right? Because I very ferociously don't want this conversation, people to walk away from it thinking, oh my gosh, we're prognosticating a future where you're, like you said, you're like cowering in the bathtub trying to find a quiet space in your own home where the broadband hopefully, the Wi-Fi hopefully still reaches, and that's how you have to work for the rest of your life. No, that is not what we're talking about. But this is really important. So is this one of the positive, the rare rays of light from this terrible pandemic, that workers, in fact, workers themselves, forget management, workers themselves for a long time have been saying, I could do my job better if you just gave me more flexibility, because some days I absolutely have to be in the office, and the social interaction and the meetings and the flow of decision making, I need to be in the middle of all that, and it's better. But some days I need to be out of the office. I mean, people have been asking for that for a long time. And did it take this pandemic to show managers or management that maybe that's not a terrible idea?
Absolutely. So this is, you know, this movement's been growing for years. Working from home's been slowly growing over the last, you know, as Cal said, going back to the early 2000s. The COVID is in some ways, you know, right now is horrible. I have four kids and I can assure you that it's not the easiest. They, you know, they're coming in and out all the time. And, you know, my broadband keeps collapsing. Post-COVID is the nirvana in the sense that we will see many firms, I think about 20% of working days and about half of Americans will get to work from home 2-3 days a week. And that's, you know, the post-COVID paradise that's going to come. Right now, we don't have that because no one can go, you know, very few of us can go into the workplace. But in the long run, this will be one of the few silver linings. I completely agree. And it shattered the stigma. Pre-COVID, there's this horrible stigma. I get, you know, just to illustrate this, I gave a talk in TEDx talk a couple of years ago, and I just pulled up under an image search on, if you go to the internet and type in working from home, and almost all the pictures were like naked people, people juggling babies, you know, people asleep, Homer Simpson, you know, it was so negative. And my friends, when I do this, would nickname it shirking from home. That has just evaporated in the last, you know, 6 to 8 weeks because people have been so happy with how working from home's turned out. But nobody wants to stick forever with full time. You know, when you interview, we've done, I've surveyed 2,500 American workers 2 weeks ago, and the large majority of them want to work from home 2-3 days a week. They just do not want to work from home full time, but they also don't want to be in the work full time either.
So you 2,000 workers, you said?
Well, 2,500.
2,500. Okay. Across a whole variety of sectors?
Yes. To be precise, we surveyed Americans aged 20 to 64 that earned $20,000 or more last year. So basically full-time working Americans. And we asked them about previously where they were working, where they're working now, and what they want to work in future. And the clear message was, in future, most people want to work from home part-time. And coming back to the previous discussion, you can see why. If I think about most of our working days, we don't need to be in the office and in group meetings every day. So the best advice is, let's say Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you're in the office, you regularly schedule it. That's the days that you have your meetings, your coffees, your lunches, your group involvement. Tuesdays and Thursdays, say, are your quiet time when you do reports, you do your reading, you do your paperwork, emails that aren't, you know, most of that stuff is not essential. It can wait probably 24 hours, and it's much more effectively done in peace and quiet at home.
Well, so Cal, let me bring you back in here because you, the end of your New Yorker article lands almost in exactly this same place, right? You write, in the future, or in this future, workflow innovations will allow remote and in-person efforts to integrate more smoothly without the need for constant email or video conferences. Goodness gracious, I hope so. But it seems like you're saying that that you'd be in agreement with what Nicholas Bloom is saying.
Oh, I am. I think I share Nicholas's optimism. You know, one of the things I reported is if you look back at past technological revolutions that intersect commerce, you see it often takes longer than you expect for the revolution to really change commerce, even after the major technologies are in place. And this is in part because lots of little small innovations are required, in essence, to mesh the new tools to the existing reality. And so one of the things I'm hoping is that the COVID experience will essentially accelerate that process. So instead of having to go through 2 or 3 decades of trying to understand how to use remote technologies to have in-person and remote work mesh together well, by forcing 40% of the working population to just do this all of a sudden, maybe we are going to have a crash course, in essence, and figure out all those little innovations in structuring and tools and procedures that's going to make this work. So that's my optimism. I share Nicholas's optimism that we may have jump-started inadvertently a better worker, a better vision of work for knowledge workers going forward.
Now, Nicholas, you actually also raise a specific example of what happened when a company had more working from home, a Chinese company named Ctrip.
Yes. So, this is a weird quirk of history, but I had the co-founder And at that point, chairman of a massive Chinese company called C-Trip, sat in the back of my PhD class at Stanford, and they wanted to test out working from home. We turned it into a formalized randomized control trial. So basically 1,000 people had volunteered to work from home and randomized them by even and odd birthdays who actually got to do it and then studied it. I mean, it was basically a scientific experiment. And what you found is quite amazingly in these employees, productivity was up 13% for those that work from home. Quit rates were halved. So, you know, they were much more productive. They loved it. The one downside, and I should say these people were working from home 4 out of 5 days a week. The one downside is promotion rates almost halved. So, you know, that tells you that working from home can be extremely productive and great for firms, but I really don't think you want to be doing it 4 or 5 days a week, because as the employee, potentially you suffer in the long run because you're out of the office, you're potentially forgotten about, you're maybe not developing managerial skills. It wasn't clear why, but they just don't get promoted at the same rate when they're at home 4 out of 5 days a week versus being full-time in the office.
Because we're human beings and face-to-face, like physical face-to-face time matters. I mean, that sort of, all those soft touch interactions really, as both of you have been saying, have make a huge difference. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in the recesses of my brain, there's a story about how when Steve Jobs designed the architecture of Apple's headquarters in Cupertino, I think he said he deliberately put all the bathrooms in one place so that people had to actually like interact with each other or see each other as they were walking towards the bathrooms or something like that. That's how much he believed in the sort of magic of the spontaneous interaction amongst Apple employees. Am I making that up? Do I remember?
No. Steve Jobs was a big proponent of being in the office. I have to say, last Monday, I was on a call with a number of very senior Silicon Valley folks, like the CEO of Facebook, et cetera. And there's a huge move now towards working from home. But again, the discussion is when the pandemic calms down, we're going to see people working from home 2-3 days a week. The other group is newbies. So new starters, people that have joined the firm afresh, are unlikely to work from home for a couple of years. So the whole setup is, once you're comfortable, once you've made connections, go work from home, but still keep it to 2-3 days a week, because you really are otherwise are going to miss this face-to-face interactions and the creativity. And also, I should say, importantly, the motivation that goes with it. It's very hard to be inspired by sitting in your bedroom for 5 days a week. You have to see other people to feel motivated and inspired.
Well, let's get a quick call in here. Let's go to Susan, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am a medical professional, and I never thought I'd ever have the opportunity to work from home. But with the type of work I do, which is medical imaging, I do post-processing, so it's quite possible to work at home because we work on a computer all day. We just recently went to all servers, and so it made it even more possible. But I love working from home. I have saved money. I used to say, it's not my job that stresses me out, it's my commute. If take that out of it, I'd be so much happier. The other thing is saving money. I don't have to have a dog walker, buying clothes. I can just turn around and go into my kitchen and get food. I don't have to buy lunch. It's just, I've been saving a lot of money. Yes, I do kind of miss seeing people's faces, but we do, we work on Teams now, Microsoft Teams, and I feel that we actually communicate better.
Really?
Than before, because we're more cohesive, we're more connected, because some of us would work in one area, in one building, and some of us would work down the street in another building. So, now there's people that we really didn't talk to much before that we are talking more on Teams.
Mm-hmm. Well, Susan, I'm going to take it back from you there. And thank you. Thank you so very much for that call. Cal Newport, I mean, Susan's work, she acknowledges her work is actually particularly well suited for remote work. She mentioned the commute again. This takes us actually back to Jack Nihlas. Nihlas, did I say that right? Jack?
Yeah, that works.
Jack, is it right?
It's actually kind of an open question. We'll go with that.
Okay. I don't like getting things wrong. So a lot of this, Susan mentioned it, it has to do perhaps not so much with the work itself, but the structure of American life writ large. Like, she just hates her commute, and so does just about everyone else who has a long commute. I mean, I was also hoping that we would hear that one of the eye-opening things coming out of this pandemic is maybe we ought to fix our infrastructure to help to alleviate the commute problem overall. I mean, I don't actually want us to stop thinking about that issue when it comes to the lives of working Americans, Cal.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, the commute issue, it's ironic since that was the original issue that got us thinking about remote work
exactly.
in the first place.
Exactly.
Though I would say now, because of COVID, people are more suspicious of more efficient modes of commuting. Trains, for example, are now something that people are thinking, maybe I'd rather be in my own car. But I think we're going to see a lot of these type of benefits that we took for granted before were impossible to reap. That we needed to be in the office. Nothing was going to happen if we aren't there. If you're a doctor, for example, well, of course you have to be in the office. And so again, this goes to the many little innovations that are going to be forced by this situation. And again, my reporting keeps making clear, it is these small innovations, the accretion of these small innovations that eventually enables large revolutions.
Well, we are talking about the future of remote work and how much of it is here to stay. We're talking with Cal Newport and Nicholas Bloom. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the future of remote work. And I'm joined today by Cal Newport, professor of computer science at Georgetown University and author of a recent article in The New Yorker titled Why Remote Work is So Hard and How It Can Be Fixed. Nicholas Bloom also joins us from Stanford, California. He's a professor of economics at Stanford University with a focus on management practices and uncertainty. Now, Cal and Nicholas, one obvious thing that must be said here is that for remote work to work, for lack of a better way of saying it, we can talk about all the tools, etc., of building teams in disparate places, but you have to have the broadband. And there's, you know, the FCC itself says 21 million Americans lack high-speed internet access. According to a report by a company called Broadband Now, they say the FCC might have underestimated that number by 20 million, that there might be upwards of 40 million Americans without adequate broadband. So if we're really going to make this work in the long run, we have to take care of that problem, don't we, Nicholas?
Yes, totally. So in the survey, actually, we collected, the Broadband Now numbers seem pretty accurate. Something like 24% of Americans said they couldn't work from home effectively because their internet was too slow. And in fact, when you look at that, that tends to be in more rural areas. So I think policy here, rolling out broadband, is, you know, essential for trying to bridge the rural-urban gap that's been growing in the U.S. Much of this, by the way, is like what's called the last mile.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much the big broadband trunk pipes, but it's connecting it. You know, you live half a mile from the main road, and you've got to connect the broadband up to your house. But that is essential because it's not only can you work effectively, if you can work effectively at home, you, of course, are going to be more easily to persuade you to socially distance. So it's not just an economic driver. It's also actually a medical driver in terms of making sure the lockdown's a success.
Cal, what do you think?
Well, I think one of the things we might see going forward, especially as the viral concerns diminish, but the interest in working from home persists, is that some locations that have a lot of benefits around them in terms of, let's say, natural beauty or access to culture or what have you, are going to invest more in trying to bring more of this broadband access as a way to actually attract exiles from the urban areas who want to shift towards full-time remote work and need that infrastructure in place. We might actually see a broadband gap that is going to evolve going forward based on different localities trying to grab their share of this new mobile workforce.
Mm. Well, let's go to Fawn, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Fawn, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity. I'm census coordinator for Hillsborough County Government. And so I've gone from an events-based, face-to-face interaction type operation to virtual, and that's been a challenge.
But, so tell me more about that, about the challenge.
Well, previously, I did this for the census. This time I'm in a different capacity. Previously, I would attend events, job fairs, churches, schools, meetings, all of those group gatherings mm-hmm. to take the message of the census and educate people on the importance of taking the census. And now that audience has dried up. So I had to figure out how to shift gears. And I shifted at first to the essentials. Everybody still has to go to the grocery store and the drug stores and those kinds of places. And so I've been able to leave material where I was allowed to do that. But then there's some hesitation despite the census being nonpartisan. It's still very political in some people's minds.
I see. Well, Fawn, thank you so much for your call and sharing your experience there. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Canton, Michigan. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello. Hi, yes, I am a nurse, and I listened to your healthcare worker that you had a few moments ago, and it brought up some feelings that I have in myself and that I cannot stay home from work. And those people who are, you know, able to work from home are saving money and have less stress for a commute. Those of us who don't have this option, who have to commute long ways and maybe even get bussed into work, that's how my work is, and, you know, are tied to a schedule and still have the money expense, I think that there's going to be some animosity, and you might see a call for people who have to commute and go in to want more money.
Yeah, Jennifer, thank you so much for bringing that up, because I think it's a really important point. Now, Nicholas Bloom, let me turn to you on that. So Jennifer makes me wonder, we have to form a whole new set of best practices around this? Because to her point, for example, if workers don't have a choice, but they're in a group where others do have a choice, should we come up with new compensation schemes for that?
It's a good question. I should say they're absolutely right that if you look in the data right now, 40% of people can work from home, but 60% of Americans can't. And in fact, on average, 30% of people are still working because they're essential service workers. And, you know, we should, as you said, we should totally thank them. These are the people keeping the country going. And the other 30% aren't working. So this is, you know, a great solution for, you know, a minority of Americans. So we do need to think hard about partly changing work as much as we can to enable as many people to work from home. But for those that can't, you're exactly right, how we can support them. You know, including through paying for transport through the tax system. It is going to be a big issue going forwards. And one of the issues actually with the current pandemic that's been problematic as well is it's helped increase inequality. If you look at jobs that can work from home, on average, they tend to be higher paid. And so, you know, in some senses, that's really not helpful, that since it's creating some, you know, as Jennifer said, some sense of a divide in the country. And I think we want to do our best to avoid that.
Well, so isn't there an opportunity here, though, to really rethink or evolve what management is? Because most management approaches that I know of involve managing a team that you see face to face here. I mean, do we even have the tools do we have to develop them to modernize managing a workforce that sort of flows in and out of the office this way?
You know, Cal's New Yorker article was fantastic. It cites evidence that I've actually looked at as well. Often these major innovations take many years to be put into place because of the challenges of change. And I think it is going to take some time for firms, you know, to get more adept. For example, many of us, one of the earlier callers mentioned that many people work across multiple offices. One of the large firms I was working with, they, you know, employees actually said, look, it's better working from home because we can now connect across multiple offices. But there are other things we need to change, the way that we organize work, to make sure that we can exploit working from home. But I think Jennifer's point was pretty essential, that there are many people that just is not going to work for now in the future. And we need to consider policy and, you know, the economics of transport, how we can support people that are going to have to go into work on a daily basis. I really want to avoid like a two-tier society where there are some people that are safely sheltered at home and others that are having to go into work every day, which is kind of what we have now. And we need to think hard how to address that.
Well, so that's why I keep coming back to maybe we should just abandon the language of work from home and instead talk about how do we build more flexible working environments, because then hopefully that's something that could seep into all different kinds of businesses and organizations. Cal, I'm thinking back to the historical examples that you got us started off with. Can you point to a couple of the lessons learned from those previous examples that we should be thinking about applying now as we move forward into this new world where it's not going to be either or?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind is that historically we find that there's an underestimated amount of value that's placed on the occasional face-to-face. So I talked about in the article, for example, the surprising amount of times that the major leaders during World War II would fly through enemy territory, very dangerous flights, or take ships across the Atlantic so that they could meet face-to-face. Churchill going to France, Marshall going to England, Churchill coming across Nova Scotia to meet with Roosevelt. So we've learned historically that there is going to be value occasionally to this face-to-face. So we have to understand how to keep that in place. I think another thing that we need to be concerned about is internal inequities. These type of things arise, unexpected internal inequities. So imagine you have two classes of worker within your organization, some who are in the office and some who are remote. Those who are in the office, as Nicholas's research shows, might have a faster path through promotion because they're getting face time. Well, who's that going to be? Mainly younger people, probably more likely to be men than women because of caregiving responsibilities. And so you might accidentally, if we don't pay attention to these side effects, end up essentially selecting for one group of people for the management class versus another. And I'm not sure if, for example, making young men the core of our future of corporate governance is definitely what we want to do.
Terrible idea.
Another lesson to have historically is that, you know, as we figure out these innovations, how is this going to work? How do we solve the practical productivity problems? There are these other issues that are going to orbit that we have to be aware of and keep our eyes open for.
Well, Nicholas Bloom, we have about 30 seconds left, so I'll leave you with our last thought about how we should all be moving forward here.
You know, I think we should just, as you said, embrace the fact that we have the possibility to roll out working from home. My research suggests it's going to increase fourfold from pre to post COVID, and that's great. But I don't think it's going to be full time. So I think we really need to be focused on 2-3 days a week. And we have to focus on making sure that this benefits everyone.
Well, Nicholas Bloom is a professor of economics at Stanford University with a focus on management practice. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Cal Newport, professor of computer science at Georgetown University and author of a recent New Yorker article titled Why Remote Work is Hard and How It Can Be Fixed. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Cal.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay, we've got one more story today. This one's about how necessity is the mother of invention, even in the world of remote work.
I love it when technology abruptly gets used for something weird and benign and not its intended purpose.
That's Nate Crowley. He's the reviews editor for Rock Paper Shotgun, an independent site that reports on the video game industry. Now, we talked to Nate because his friend Viv Schwartz recently had quite an amazing idea. No more Zoom, no more groaning to people, you've got to unmute yourself. Viv decided their team was going to have their work meetings in an entirely different way. Viv wondered, what if they had their meetings inside a video game? Well, Nate picks up the story from here.
To break the monotony, they decided to try and work out where would be the least appropriate place possible to meet. And Viv suggested Red Dead Redemption 2, which is, for those not familiar, an exactingly detailed cowboy simulator, essentially. In the online mode, you get together with a posse of cowboys. Cowboys, in this case, being a gender-neutral term. Anyone can be a cowboy. Your cowboys ride around an incredibly granular, realistic, you know, enormous depiction of the American West at the turn of the 20th century. And it's meant for this really immersive, almost sort of Westworld-like experience of being a cowboy. And they decided to use it for conference calling. So they started having their team meetings around a campfire with their cowboys, and it ended up being way more appropriate than they expected, because the cowboys sort of look like they're having a meeting. They're sat there around the fire, sort of nodding their heads, scratching their chins, and staring off into the middle distance with that polite attentiveness, but slight boredom, that well-acquainted colleagues will take on during a long meeting, talking about commerce as the wolves howl in the distance. And then, of course, there's Cripps.
Make yourself at home. It is your home.
Cripps is a non-player character. Is an AI entity who looks after your camp.
Place is pretty nice. I'll earn my keep. And I'd rather work.
Calling him artificially intelligent might be a little generous. He's this sort of wispy-bearded goblin who just sits around playing a mouth harp incessantly. In fact, you have to play a little bit of the game, or else the server kicks you off for being idle for too long. So Viv and their colleagues got around this by constantly making coffee. That's one of the things the cowboys can do, and it seemed, you know, again, like pretty good role-playing of being in a corporate environment. And it's quite a relaxing environment to talk through things in, because it's not all, you know, gunfights and dynamite. You can just have a nature walk. There's 234 animals in the game. There's like a dozen kinds of small, lovely woodland birds. You can just have a stroll around looking at the scenery, because it really is gorgeous. And yeah, it's the same effect as walking and talking with a colleague in the real world, only we can't do that at the moment. At a time where it's very easy to become sort of ambiently agoraphobic, stuck inside all the time, it's quite a release to have these outdoor spaces which are consequence-free. I think that's quite beautiful.
That's Nate Crowley, reviews editor for the website Rock Paper Shotgun. Nate's talking about his friend Viv Schwartz's absolutely awesome idea of ditching Zoom and having work meetings inside a video game, in their case, Red Dead Redemption 2. And quite frankly, I think this sounds superior to even some of the in-person meetings that many of us have to suffer through every day in the pre-COVID world, and who knows, maybe the post-COVID world too, if people get back to office work. So what I really want to know, though, is would you do this? Would you have your meetings inside a video game? And if so, which video game would you choose? Send us a tweet or find us at Facebook at On Point Radio. And by the way, Nate said that when the meeting is over inside Red Dead Redemption 2, you can all jump on your horses and ride off into the sunset, which is a lot less awkward, I'd say, than everyone smiling at the camera while they're trying to sign off. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.